Shopomaniacs, you are listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front end web design development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody. You know, if you've listened to last week, that's wonderful. I highly encourage you to listen to every week of the Shop Talk Show because it's just endless insight. But if you did, you'll know that I don't actually care if you did or didn't. You know, it's great to have you back for this episode, you know. But you would know that we've kicked off a little bit of a mini series here on Chop Talk Show. Mini series is called How to Think Like a Front-End Developer. And we're not here to tell you how to think like a front-end developer. It's mostly like we're going to talk to some other front-end developers, as we do here on the show, but kind of hone in on some, what does it mean to be a front-end developer? Can we dig into a front-end developer's brains a little bit? And I don't know, just figure out how they think and kind of ask the same questions to a series of different front-end developers to see if we can hone in on any similarities and highlight any interesting differences into how front-end developers think. So we have what I would consider to be a front-end developer, one of the best dang front-end developers there is out there today, Mina Markham. Hey, Mina.
Hey, Chris, thank you very much. I did a little happy dance when you called me one of the best, so yay.
Yeah. Well, heck yeah, you are. You've had some, you know, I've done some incredible work and had some incredible output, like very directly in the field of front-end development. But I guess that's an interesting way to start this. Do you think of yourself as straight, like, is that your job title? Do you think of yourself, I am Mina, I am a front-end developer?
Yeah, I do. I consider myself to be a front-end developer, yeah.
What does that mean? Like, what are the main characteristics of that? What makes you a front-end developer and not something else?
The work that I do is mostly, it deals with things that you can see, things that are actually in front of you on the screen in a web client and a client. And yeah. In my mind, anyone who works on a, you know, user-facing interface or application, website, whatever, in my mind, that's a front-end developer. Like, regardless of where you fall technology-wise, whether you're mostly on the JavaScript side, CSS, markup, mm-hmm. accessibility, like, if you deal with code and your code is users interact with pieces, like, parts of your code, in my mind, you're a front-end developer.
Yeah, users interact with parts of your code, you're a front-end developer. That's nice. So, like, where could we, by saying that, you're saying there's different, certainly you could specialize in different things. You could be doing lots of different things and you'd all still be front-end developers. Like, you're a front-end developer with certain skills, but there could be somebody else who does kind of different work, but is still a front-end developer.
Yeah, that's, I would say so. Like, there is, front-end development's like a wide breadth of skills and technologies. And you can, if you want, specialize in one specific kind of niche part of it, but it's still front-end development.
So what do you think about that name then? Is it like too broad? Do you think we should have like more job titles or more kind of subsections of what front-end development is? Or is that maybe useful or not useful?
I don't know how useful further, like, categorization or dividing would be, because I feel like sometimes job titles feel kind of meaningless in some cases, because people will think of them differently. Like, the whole point of this series that you're doing, at least is what I assume is the point, is that trying to figure out how different people define the same thing. So having multiple subcategories, I think, would just lead to a little bit more confusion about what each one means.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be worse. Could be, if there is a problem, which
we can start going with the whole, like, there's 1,001 like web standards and like JavaScript standards and JavaScript frameworks, which they're all JavaScript frameworks, but like they all approach things a little bit differently. So I can just kind of see that fragmentation happening with the various different types of like different categorization of front end development, so to speak.
Like, what would they be? Would they be like, I'm a JavaScript engineer and I'm a performance person and I'm a accessibility specialist. And
I think that that probably is how I would see them being broken down is I'm a JavaScript developer. I'm a CSS developer. I specialize in accessibility compliance or performance. But even in that category, I could see like JavaScript developer could mean a lot of things. Do you focus on React? Are you focused on Vue or Angular or whatever the framework of the moment is? So even like that categorization could have lots of subcategories.
So that became a little bit of a hot topic. I guess it never really leaves is the like, you know, how much JavaScript do you need to know to be a front end developer? Is zero acceptable? And if it's zero, is there like, what do you think about that?
Yeah. My answer to that is probably controversial, but I think it would be zero. And I only say that because I've observed that knowing zero about CSS and markup tends to be acceptable. So in my mind, that the opposite should be true.
Oh, I like it. It's almost like retribution in a way. Like if you're a JavaScript developer that is terrible at HTML and CSS, somehow you get to be a front-end developer still. But if it's the other way around...
Yeah, that is actually all I ask. Whenever I see this argument being like, resurfacing, my only real stake in it is that we treat everything equally. So if it is acceptable to not know CSS or HTML or anything about accessibility and still be employable and still be considered a front-end developer or an engineer, then the opposite should be true if we're going to treat every technology as equally important.
That is a fascinating way to do this, and I love it.
I said it might be controversial, but yeah.
I don't know that it will be. I mean, maybe it will, because I guess everything is controversial these days.
How dare you? How dare you apply the same standards to other people that you do to yourself? That's ridiculous.
Oh, fascinating. What about this, like, I don't know. I'm gonna say something that almost sounds like my own opinion, but I'm trying not to do that, you know, but we'll just see how it goes. That, like, do you think that just HTML and CSS is enough? We've already established that, yes, you can be a front-end developer, like, that can be your job title, but it's more common or desirable or something that generally if you're best at HTML and CSS and left JavaScript, that you don't know that one, that generally you kind of fill in that space, if there is any, with something else, that you're also kind of a designer or you're also very into performance or accessibility or, I don't know, business stuff or social media or something, that it's HTML and CSS plus.
How do I answer that?
It could just be, no, you're a dummy.
No, it's not, no, you're a dummy. No, I think that being like a website without JavaScript or application without JavaScript is going to be, you know, fairly basic and like not very interactive. Like, I understand that. So I think that being just knowing those two skills, just knowing markup and CSS won't be enough. But the point that I was making before is that if, like, these are all, in my mind, they're all very intertwined. And so having a good, having competency in all of them is important. But yeah, if we're going to say you could be a niche, you can kind of niche or specialize in a certain subset of those skills, then if you're leaning more towards the HTML, CSS part of the stack, so to speak, that's probably corresponds to you're more of a, you focus more on the visual aspects of it and having an eye for design, having a keen awareness of what makes something accessible, like those skills. Yes, they're supplementary skills. And I think that they would only increase your value on a team that may necessarily be lacking in those parts, if that makes any sense.
Okay, so we've kind of figured out a little bit of what a front-end developer is or what the potential is. So, but you know what you know, and you're a front-end developer. I'd love to know what, like, you're going into a new project, and this project could be any project you want it to be, and it could have any team you want it to be, and your role in this could be anything at all. What, you know, but you're the front-end developer. You know, that's your role in it, but it could take whatever forms we decide that a front end developer would take in a project. Like, what is perfect for you? What is an ideal situation like that? And you know what I mean? Like, what a perfect project comes your way and you're the front end developer. Describe it. Set the scene.
Set the scene for my perfect project. Wow. Well, I've figured out that my skill set is probably best at when design and engineering converge. I started my career as a designer, and I have since like transitioned into full-time web development, and I taught myself front-end development. So I have like one foot in like the visual design world and one foot in the engineering world. So that's why I kind of gravitate towards things like design systems, and where my career has kind of shifted to doing mostly design system work, because that is where these two worlds tend to converge. So my perfect project would be something that allows me to, I don't want to say just creating design systems, because I love that work, but I also love building the products and that the design system powers as well. But anything that allows me to collaborate very closely with a designer, and to enact, to recreate their vision in the most, I guess, modular and scalable way, that's usually where I shine. And that project might look like a marketing site that has varying different pieces that need to be repeated across, like scaled across multiple pages, or in some cases, multiple like brands. So figuring out how to take this large scale project and how to break that down into scalable, reusable pieces. That's where I love. That's where I live. That's my wheelhouse right there. And that could be just doing the user interface, like just focusing on the UI, but it also could mean taking the functionality of it and creating taking the full functionality of it and making the JavaScript part of it, and doing more like scalable functional JavaScript as well. That could come into it, unless there's someone else who's like more capable of doing that part. But yeah, I feel like I got off track a little bit, but essentially,
no, you didn't. I was letting you go there because I just wanted to just live in that world for a,
but considerably, I feel like working on the past two major projects I've worked on, both HillaryClinton.com and Slack.com, that were actually both perfect projects for me, because I got to do, they were both kind of greenfield, and I got to focus on first, what does the CSS architecture and organization look like? So I got to think about how I wanted the code to look and feel. And then I got to focus on how do I take all of these layouts I'm seeing and modularize them and make them so that our developers can build with great velocity and still maintain that consistency and code quality that we need and that I come to expect. So both of those projects, I would say, are probably like perfect things for me.
That's nice that you've landed in the job that you're actually paid for is perfect for you, you know?
Yeah. I got really lucky.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Native Script. It's nativescript.org/shoptalkshow, of course. It's a great name for a product because it's how to build native apps, like native to iOS, like a native iOS app and a native Android app, which, you know, are totally two separate languages that you need to write in to create apps in that way. And obviously that's a problem, right? Like, not every business can afford to rewrite an app twice, nor is it particularly efficient or very fun. So developers are always looking for a solution for that. You know, we're like, wouldn't it be nice if we could like have a web app, but also have native apps in the store? And there's web wrapper type of web view stuff you can do for that, but it's not super ideal. It's not nearly as nice as an actual legit native app code driven application. So that's what Native Script does. You can write your app in JavaScript, or if you want to write in TypeScript, that's cool. You can even use a framework, Angular or Vue, super popular frameworks, of course. Write your app that way, and NativeScript turns it into a native app for you. So get 100% access to all the native APIs with JavaScript, and reuse still packages from NPM, all the stuff that you're used to being able to use, you can use it with NativeScript. So pretty darn cool. Check it out, nativescript.org/shoptalkshow.
You mentioned like working with designers. Is there kind of a limit on the numbers of designers you like to work with on one project? Because I find I max out at about three. So,
I feel like I haven't actually worked with more than three at any given time. So maybe that's a good max to say as well. Like usually it's been one-on-one. Sometimes it's a couple. But yeah, I don't think I've ever actually had to actively work with more than three designers at one time.
Right. Because I really enjoy that working with designers work, because when it's working, and I know you work with talented designers at Slack as well, you know, but when you're kind of firing and feedback and changes are all happening very in a good flow, that's a really great feeling.
Usually when I'm doing these last two projects, I'm usually working on a system, like a design system, and the actual thing that it powers at the same time, the actual website. I find myself needing to do lots of quick iterations because we'll find that something that works in one context doesn't work in a different context. So having that like really close collaborative relationship with a designer has been key for when I have to like make changes or tweaks to the design to make sure that they're stress tested and robust. Having that very close working relationship builds that trust that they let me do that and without a lot of friction.
So if we're setting the stage here again for this ideal MENA project, it is that you're working with at least one designer or up to three, one to three designers, and that they've delivered you some kind of design. But you like the design part too, but maybe it's even better for you, especially because your role in this project is front-end developer, that you're interpreting their designs, but what they're like, you're still able to communicate and have your own kind of design input.
Yes and no. I don't want to say that I want to have like design input, but I don't really change designs unless there's actually something that's not working. And even then it's a collaborative process with the designers. I think that if we're going to paint my perfect project, I want to be able to have that working relationship so that I basically, it's not like a throwing over the fence thing. Like they throw me a design and then I just build it one to one, and there's no reciprocation, there's no collaboration. And I feel like having that close working relationship, that collaboration would just make the interface, the finished product, better for everyone.
So there's no fences here. That's all.
I don't like the waterfall. I don't like the fences. It's more of just like, okay, here's what I built this thing. I built it in, I usually build something in isolation, like, because I do design systems work. So I'll build it inside the design system, like in isolation, like one piece of UI by itself. And then I'll build it in the context it was designed in. And if I see something as a miss in one of those two things, that's where the collaboration starts. It's like, okay, it's working here, but it's not working here. So what do you see? Like, how can we fix it in one of that it works in both of these scenarios? Like, I love that interaction.
And that this is not simple one-off. You like the challenge of there's enough complexity and enough different pages, enough different things going on that you're extra valuable because you can bring some like design system thinking to the project. That's kind of, it's ideal that it's complex in a way.
Yeah. I do like a certain level of complexity because it does, you know, it gets me a little bit more involved in several parts of the process. And I always feel like I learn something new every time I do this kind of work, because of course projects are always very different. So I love having just enough complexity so that I kind of keeps me on my toes, so to speak.
So you're working on this project. Let's say it's your ideal one, or maybe let's say it's not your ideal one. It's something more day to day or whatever. It's just a normal project, or and you're handed a design and it's, you know, you're doing your day to day work. What's like the hardest part of your day to day work? Like what's the hardest part of a project like this, or life as a front end developer? And like maybe scoped to technological problems rather than, because I feel like if I answer this question 10 times without any caveats, people would, 10 out of 10 people would be like, my manager, or dealing with other human beings on the project. Like, not always their manager, but like interpersonal things is sometimes always the hardest part about work. So
Jeff from accounting.
Yeah, it's always Jeff's fault.
Jeff in accounting. The hardest part about any particular project or a particular project, sometimes it would be figuring out which technology is the best one to use. Mm. And this is in a scenario where the stack has not been decided for you, because sometimes you don't have a choice in those matters. But yeah. It's been my experience that people have a lot of opinions about like what particular like framework or approach to take. And so sometimes just figuring out which one is actually the best, regardless of like what personal opinions are about them, can feel kind of it feels kind of messy. Usually, I feel like a lot of times you don't have a say about that because the stack has been decided.
Are you worried about it making the wrong choice, or are you like you don't even know what choices to make, or that's like just too much to evaluate time wise?
Sometimes I don't know if I'm worried about making the wrong choice because I don't necessarily know if there are like wrong choices. They're just different choices. But I guess I'm usually worried about, actually, I take it back. I am worried about making the wrong choice. What I mean by the wrong choice, I'm making the wrong choice for the larger, our workflow or for interacting with different parts of the code base. There's a lot of choices. There's a breadth of choices. So sometimes it's just analysis, like it's paralysis, like too many options. But also I'm concerned that it might not be the best choice, like performance wise. Like maybe I picked a technology or a framework that is a little bit slower and I didn't realize that. And now I'm too far down the road to like make that switch or something.
That switch is interesting, right? Like it's because you can, there's some technology choices that you can make that are no big deal that you can back right out of. And some of them that you absolutely cannot back out of easily.
That's the part I worry about. Like if I make the wrong choice, like how painful will it be to go back and correct this choice?
And like, are these kind of decisions or deliberations, are they like hour things, day things, week things?
I guess it would depend on the scope of the project and how many people are involved. Like it could be a very brief conversation. Like if you're choosing, if you're doing unit tests, should we go with Jeff? Should we go with Karma? Like there's a couple of, sometimes it could be a very quick conversation, but if you're doing like larger scale work that affects like many moving pieces, then it might be a longer conversation because you have to make sure you're doing the best for as many people or who are going to be affected by it.
So choice making seems like a little bit of a theme and challenging, but there's other choices that have to be made other than just like what high level tech are we going to use? Do you find yourself, it's easy for you to make general choices, just not?
Yeah, I feel like I can generally make decent decisions about how I want to tackle creating or coding up a particular part of a project. Like, I feel like those kind of choices I make pretty easily. It's just when there's something that has larger implications than just like the work I'm doing right now, those choices tend to be a little hairier.
What about organizational choices? Like literal code organization choice.
I think the very first time I had to make one of those choices, like how I wanted to structure my code base, that took a little bit of time and trying to figure out what made the most sense in my mind. But now I think I've made those choices already. So I feel like I start projects very similarly and I organize my code very similarly once I made that initial choice, like way back whenever I made it. And it's generally a personal preference because I tend to, because I do more of the, I guess, CSS leadership where I go, my personal choice ends up becoming the team's choice, whether they like it or not. Sorry, team. I've figured out how I like to structure code, what makes the most sense in my mind. And after I've made that, once I make that decision, it's usually I start the same project every project the same way. So it's a one and done kind of choice. At least it has been.
That's pretty interesting. I like it. That your some choices that you've made have served you well over time. You know, that like you're like, I don't know, I had to think about this once, but
yeah, I might make a few tweaks to it here and there, but generally like I organize code pretty much the same way.
Do you have like a preferred stack that you kind of carry around? Like I imagine you use SAS, you're very involved in the SAS community. What tools do you reach for instantly?
I usually reach for SAS, although SAS really, I'm using it more for its import and partial structure as opposed to a lot of the actual functionality it can do, just because CSS has gotten more powerful in the past few years. But I use SAS. I usually use vanilla JavaScript. I don't have a particular framework that I reach for in that sense. It's usually just ES6 and straight vanilla JavaScript. For accessibility testing, I usually reach for Axe, the dev tools, the extension in Chrome. Use Axe for that to check for any accessibility errors and whatnot. There's also this thing I use for layout debugging called CSS Pesticide, which I don't really remember when I found this, but I usually use that whenever I find something funky happening when I'm viewing the UI. I use that to kind of start trying to debug where it's going on. I usually just use a lot of vanilla code. I don't reach for a lot of like specific tools.
So, you know, you right now, what is your, I mean, we've covered your into design systems and things. Do you consider that your specialty, or what do you, if you're a front-end developer, what do you consider your specialism within that arena?
If I was going to say I specialize in anything, you would probably be specializing in modular and scalable CSS, which lends itself to design systems work.
Okay, so that's, and I don't think everybody would say that. I think, you know, even if you know CSS well, your specialty may not be the scaling of CSS.
I guess that's true. That's true. I like that part of it because I feel like it's an interesting challenge. Like just writing really well structured CSS is, you know, a great, you know, is a great skill and a great competency to have. But there's something about the challenge of making sure that it can scale and it can be easily maintained by a large group of people down the road that I find kind of exciting.
It'd be fascinating to like, what do you see? Do you see sometimes when maybe a fellow team member or somebody on a different project or something write some CSS and you look at that and you're like, that ain't going to scale. Do you have moments like that? I mean, they're probably, it's not like that they're bad developers. It's just kind of a teaching moment perhaps when, what do you see with your like matrix vision of like, this is going to be a problem?
Because we use CSS preprocessors, usually when I see a lot of nesting is my first clue. Like, okay, that's going to be kind of hard to scale because that code looks pretty fragile. Like if anything about that structure changes at some point, which it probably will, that's going to break.
It's funny that it's almost counterintuitive, isn't it? Sometimes you see a lot of nesting, you're like, well, it almost is resilient in a way because the selector that gets output is going to be so specific that there's probably not going to be that many side effects from it because it matches so few other things.
Yeah. And in that sense, yeah, that's usually why people do it, because it is so specific that styles won't leak anywhere. So that's one side of it. But when I look at it, I'm thinking, okay, that selector, like that bit of code, that selector can only exist in that form. If you try to do anything else different to it, you have to change this. You have to make a new selector. You have to change what you're trying to target because it's no longer targeting the very, very specific thing you want it to. So in that sense, I can see if you're writing your code in a way where everything is either very deeply nested or you have very, very specific selectors, it just means that you're going to have to write even more code when you want to do any kind of alterations or overrides or if anything about your HTML structure changes. So when the selector is both very specific and very tightly coupled to a specific HTML structure, in my mind, that signifies this is probably not going to scale well in a different kind of scenario.
That's great. It really is a hard one to learn in CSS that I feel like I'm still trying to learn in some ways. Sometimes you're like, I just want to be safe about this, but then you're shooting yourself in the foot two ways. You know, you nest too deeply, changes in the HTML can screw you up because it's whatever, you know, it's not a child of what you thought it was a child of anymore or something. And that it's just, it probably does something simple, you know, it's some header and it's got a little bit of padding and it makes it, you know, red, that later you need some of that same style and you don't have that selector available to you. So you got to write it all over again. And then one or the other of them changes and now your styles are out of sync and it causes more problems than you're protecting against in a way.
I understand the impulse because when I was starting to write CSS, like I would also like write either using IDs or writing very specific selectors because I didn't want the style leakage that happens. But yeah, more often than not, I ended up having to like duplicate a lot of very similar code because the selector no longer applied to what I was trying to target.
Wonderful. So Mina specialisms. Okay. So there's certain, fights that we all like to fight sometimes, or some things that we all feel pretty strongly about in the, you know, maybe we don't bring those opinions to Twitter necessarily, but we have them. Or so, you know, something that you're willing to be like, you know, when I start a project, like my careometer is all the way topped out on this one. Like, I really think that we should go this road, and you're willing to stand up for it on a particular project. And then likewise, other things where you're just like, I could care less about that choice. Somebody else make it. So the way I phrase this question is, what wars do you like to wage and which wars do you stay away from?
Man, I don't like to fight at all. Honestly, can we just not?
Sure.
So I guess I mentioned it earlier, but there's the one fight that I will have, and it's a hill that I will die on happily, is that CSS, HTML markup, accessibility, JavaScript, they are all equally important in the front-end development like ecosystem, and we should not wait one more than the other, particularly when it comes to disregarding certain skill sets and not valuing certain skill sets. And it's been my experience that CSS and HTML skills tend to get undervalued because they're either seen as easy or, you know, they aren't because they more often than not won't lead to like an app not functioning properly or a website not functioning properly. They're seen as less important. And I wholeheartedly disagree with that aspect. Like, I think all of those things are equally important. They should all be treated with the same respect.
So how would that manifest at a war or at a job, perhaps? And you don't have to stick about your current job, because or whatever. But would it be like, I think, you know, would it be you standing up at a meeting and saying like, we really don't have any HTML specialists here and I think we could benefit from that? And, or would it be a salary?
It's a probably, correction? I would say, as much as I would know how much other people are making, I think it would be a little bit of a salary thing, because it's, I don't have any facts or figures to give you, but I see if someone was specializing in just those particular things and was not like at a certain level of JavaScript competency or whatever, I could see the compensation reflecting that. I've been a part of enough hiring panels and interviews to know that if a person doesn't have a certain level of JavaScript competency, they're more likely not to get that job versus if they don't know accessibility compliance or CSS very well. They're more likely to get the job if those two things are not up to par than if the JavaScript skill is not up to par. And that inequity feels odd to me. So it manifests itself when I'm usually the person in a hiring panel raising a flag saying, hey, yeah, this part of their code and this part of their skill is great, but, you know, their exercise wasn't as accessible at all. So I just want to flag that and call that out. And I'm not saying a person shouldn't be hired if that's lacking. I just want to make sure we acknowledge that is something that is lacking. It also manifests itself where I usually am the person on a team that is like waving the flag for like making sure that our interfaces are accessible. I mentioned a lot about make sure we tab through it, that the keyboard, like people with who are navigating via keyboard only can access every part of the interface they need to. Let's make sure the color contrast is still is visible and it's in the realm of acceptable realm for visually impaired users. And so I feel like the fight comes when I just want to make sure that those other aspects are considered before we say something is done.
Okay. Is there any front end dev holy wars or hot topics or anything that you just roll your eyes at or don't care about?
There's the, I kind of see rears up your head a couple of times at the space versus tabs war, which I have an opinion. It doesn't really matter. For the record, I like spaces, but it's not a war that I get really invested in. Like, if the code base I'm working in is tabs, whatever, it's tabs, I will deal. Also, like, the code editor wars, like, some people will live and die by Sublime or live and die by Atom. I like VS Code. I think it's great, but again, I'm not going to take up arms and say everyone should use VS Code. Like, use whatever you want. I really don't care.
That's always the weird one that people kind of scoff at, like, you're still using that.
I've heard that happen a couple of times.
I kind of don't care because they're all so good. Yeah. But if you used one that sucked, I might have a problem as a boss, because I'm like, well, first of all, like, we run prettier. We all have to run it or it's no good. You know, like, that's true. The point of it is that it really strongly enforces this thing. So, like, I don't care which one you use as long as you get prettier working in it, because I don't want my commits to be fixing your syntax, you know?
That's true. I think the holy wars are basically like the JavaScript frameworks. Like, is it React, or you're still using React, or you're still using Vue, or you're still using Angular? I don't care. You use whatever makes the most sense for your projects. But yeah, I feel like every time a new developer or a new engineer joins a job, when they find out what the stack is, there's always a, hey, have you tried using this? It's like, it may be better. It may fit your personal preference. But yeah, I honestly don't have a strong opinion.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Rollbar. One of the most frustrating things we all deal with in our day-to-day development lives is dealing with errors, you know? Like, we don't want to be relying on our users to be reporting errors to us or searching through log files to try to debug issues. Such a waste of time. Time that could have been spent coding. With Rollbar, you instantly know what's broken and why. So Rollbar detects when code breaks in real time and provides a full stack trace and diagnostic data to help you defeat these impactful errors. You can integrate Rollbar into your existing workflow pretty easily. You can have errors be sent to, you know, your HipChat or Slack or whatever, or create new issues in Jira or Pivotal Tracker or Trello or whatever. You can add the Rollbar JavaScript SDK super easily into an app. It's just a few lines of code, some JavaScript you need to add to your thing. Here's a, you know, speaking of JavaScript, for you JavaScript nerds, here's a couple of cool features. One, it has source map support. So if, you know, even if you're shipping like super minified code, it will look at your source map and still give you a stack trace through your JavaScript to the place the error actually happened. Super useful. And telemetry. JavaScript telemetry gives a timeline of browser events leading up to an error. So it's like a black box recorder for when your web app crashes. Go to rollbar.com/shoptalkshow. Get the Bootstrap plan for free. So it's used by, you know, Heroku, Twilio, Kayak, Zendesk, all kinds of. Give Rollbar a try for free. That's rollbar.com/shoptalk. So, you know, you worked on Hillary's campaign, right? For quite a while there. And weren't you one of the earliest?
I was engineer hire number one, actually.
Number one?
Yeah, I was hired directly after the CTO was.
Okay. So I don't know if your role necessarily was hiring, but were you a part of hiring or helping find other people?
I was for up until probably towards the end of the campaign, I helped do the initial screen for every engineering candidate.
every engineering candidate. Well, you're uniquely qualified to talk about this then. That's wonderful. Okay. When you were in those initial screenings, what was like a great thing to hear and what was like a terrible thing to hear? This is important for people out there, I would think. If you were trying to get a job as a front-end developer, like, listen up.
I think, again, just the context of that particular hiring was a little different. So some things don't apply. But I think the main thing that was great to hear was that they were willing to learn and get up to speed very quickly. We're using React and I think Nuclear and a bunch of other, at the time, kind of like early technologies. And so we needed someone who was very capable of getting caught up quickly and getting up to speed quickly. So someone who had enthusiasm about like learning a particular technology, regardless of what technology was, but they had a passion for like being able to learn something new. That was great because they were going to be thrown in kind of head first and needed to be able to like learn and pick up the framework, pick up our technologies, pick up how we worked very quickly. So someone who had this strong drive to teach themselves was really helpful. And I think that would apply to pretty much any job. Like, anytime you go to a new company, you're going to end up learning like how they do things a little bit different than how anyone else does it. So being able to like learn on your feet and enjoy learning on your feet is a great skill.
Would the reverse of that be a bummer or a red flag if somebody's just like, listen, I'm amazing. So I got this system. I'm willing to bring it to you.
Yeah, I would have a huge red flag for someone who seems unwilling to, one, admit that they don't know something, unwilling to admit that they may be wrong about something, and unwilling to continue to grow as a professional. Like, those are really big red flags for me, because this world that we live in, this profession that we have, is constantly evolving. And if you want to stay kind of stagnant and like in your comfort zone, I don't know how, like, you might get left behind is the sad truth of it. So yeah, anything that kind of signifies that there's a lot of like resistance to change is a little bit of a red flag to me.
Was there any other, you remember any screens where you're just like, whoa, no.
I don't think there was ever like a hard no on my end. It was more like, okay, maybe we should give them like an actual, like more in-depth interview to see how they fare. Like the initial screens were more just, it was about rating out like really big red flags. And unfortunately for me in that scenario, I didn't get a lot of huge, like obvious red flags.
I find your approach very similar to mine. So it's hard to critique.
So you're saying we're both right, Dave, right?
Yeah, I think this is the best one, and we can wrap up the series.
I've had similar thoughts about, you know, when you're hiring, sometimes the role that you're, the applicants that you get are already so good that you're like, I'm not gonna like decide that you're terrible. It's a rare day when somebody's so bad that they don't even pass the first screening, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe at other jobs though. I bet at Slack the door is knocking a little harder. And
I'm not involved in like the initial process of Slack. I interview once they're in the office. So at that point, like if you made it through that point, like you're not a terrible person or engineer. So there's not a lot of like obvious like no's.
All right, so on to the next section of our program here. This is kind of a fun section that's a little tricky over radio, but if you listened last week, you'll know that what we're doing here is kind of putting a visual design in front of our selected front-end developer guests and not having them explain the entire detail of how they might approach that visual design, but getting some insight into kind of the first thing that pops into their mind over like, okay, this is my, you know, listening to the front-end wheels start to spin in their brain and talk about what they see, what's going to be hard? Where might you have to cut corners? What's going to be the hardest part? Where's something what you're like, no, I would push back on? You know, that kind of stuff that I think all of us feel when they see designs, especially when there's an inkling that you might be tasked to actually build this thing. You're like, you know, you start to rub the chin and figure it out. So let's start with that number one. This is a dribble shot entitled For All Food Lovers by a team called Outcrowd. Are you looking at it?
I am looking at it.
All right. First thoughts.
Ooh, this is fun. no, I like it. Like it's really, I love the, I think it's kind of hard to describe over the radio, as you said, but I like, there's lots of like animation, lots of moving parts, like that big hero image at the top where the food kind of like is growing out in the pan. Yeah. Like I would love to tackle how to create these different animations. I think that might be best served in SVG. Now I'm just going to figure out like mm-hmm. animating like parts of the different parts and paths of the SVG in there. And yeah, I first approach it by making a scaffold of just the general, like, layout of the entire page. But the first immediate thing that popped into my head was, this is really cool animations and I want to play with them.
Nice. Okay. The animation was the first thing you saw here.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. The animation was the first thing that drew me to it. It was like, this is cool. I want to build this.
Okay. The next one is called Socialio by Jan Lossert, I think. And it looks, you know, for the people out there, it looks a little, I don't know, dashboard modules, you know, fairly simple design, but there's a lot, there's just a lot to see. There's a lot of lists of people and menus and headers and chunks of stuff. So what do you see when you see a page?
The first thing I see is lots of media objects. And of course, media objects, for those who may not know, it's an image or a piece of media with some content right to the side of it. And I feel like most of this design can be accomplished by creating a media object. And the only thing that kind of changes is how big that piece of media or content is. But the first thing I see is there's a lot of them here and a lot of opportunity to build one module or one component and have it repeat as many times as it needs to.
That's your design system coming out, huh?
Like, yeah, that's my design system thing. I've seen lots of patterns and lots of repeatable patterns in this one.
That's nice that you don't see, even people that think in patterns, you don't think this is 20 patterns. You're almost seeing one.
I see one like underlying pattern, and then I see like opportunities to build on top of that pattern as need be.
Let's move on to this shot entitled Sibling, Steve Wolf. It's kind of more simple than the first two that we looked at least, you know, visually there's less going on here. It's more of a poster almost. Mm-hmm. What do you think when you see this one?
The first thing I'm thinking of is, oh, cool, writing modes. I can use the writing mode to turn, because there's a couple of headlines that are written vertically. So the first thing I'm seeing there is opportunity to use that. But I'm also trying to think, because this is more of a, poster and not really a website, I'm starting to think, well, how could I render this responsibly? Like, if I wanted to make it look very well, like look really good on a smaller viewport, like what would I do? How would I change that? So I'm starting to think of, okay, well, what's the actual hierarchy of information here? Like Sibling, I guess, would be the title. So is the next thing going to be that how to lean headline going there? So I'm starting to think of like, how do I order what's the source order of all the information? And then how would I reorganize it based on how much available space I have?
Because it seems like what we're looking at here is more of a, you'd only use this layout if you had like kind of a lot of room.
Yeah. It's definitely a lot of horizontal room. So if I had less, like more vertical space, less horizontal room, how would I rearrange this?
Yeah. So you're just thinking responsively right out of the gate here.
Yep. Again, I really would like to build this one too, just so I could play around with like different configurations of how to make this look good in the various available viewports.
When you work with designers, do you typically get mobile comps that you then kind of responsibly make into a desktop, or do you get a desktop comp that you kind of...
Who gets mobile comps? Do you? That feels
like, well, I mean, actually,
there's one or two shops out there.
I do. I usually get a desktop comp that has been refigured into a mobile comp by the designer. So I usually do get both.
Just you get a kind of before after.
Yeah, I do get a little bit of both, and then it's usually up to me or whatever, or the other front end engineer on the project to figure out what happens in between those two. And that's where a lot of that collaboration comes into play, where I'll start looking at it in those in between, I guess you call it kind of like keyframes. Like, here's the mobile keyframe, and here's like another keyframe for desktop. But like in between those two, here's some funkiness happening. So what do we do in this part where this gets started to get funky in this part here? And
keyframes. I've never heard them called that before. That's great.
This is the first time I actually said that, but it seemed to make sense. Like, here's how this design lives in this one moment. Here's how it lives in this particular moment. And you got to figure out what happens in between the two. So it seemed to make sense.
It's like, does this scale up? Does this just flow along? Does this just,
All right. This last one is similar in a way to the first one. It's kind of visually heavy and has some animations and scroll stuff. It's like kind of a homepage for a festival. It looks like, you seeing this one?
Oh yeah, this is cool. I like this one. So the first thing I'm seeing is I'm guessing that really big, that big visual of this, I guess it's a gorilla.
That's also like, an island, apparently.
Yeah, a gorilla with an island on top of his head. So the first thing I'm seeing there is, oh, wow, that would be really cool. But how would I do that? I'm guessing it might be easiest to make that like a background video and not attempt to recreate that with code. Maybe, depending on how big the video was and how performant it could be, maybe.
I see, because there's little, like the water's moving and stuff. Like
that's, yeah, the water's moving, like, and there's little bubbles coming out of his nose. And then there's the birds that are flying around his head. I'm like, there's a lot of moving pieces there. So I feel like it might be the most performant to attempt to just have a video do that and not attempt to like animate every little node there happening.
Right.
But I'm seeing some animation happening like below that too, with some of these, I'm guessing they're speaker kind of blurbs or whatever. So maybe that would be, I could do that with CSS or JavaScript animation, like those little bubbles that are flowing out of there. But again, I'm seeing lots of like, there's lots of like scroll, when you scroll down, there's lots of kind of fade in and ups happening. So I'm thinking about how I would do that, like detecting where you are when you scroll and timing that animation to happen, that animation up, fade up to happen. And also now I'm thinking about how I would do this like responsively, because this could get kind of hairy in a smaller viewport. And I guess at a wider one, what would you do? Would you just, I guess you could just like have a max width and be done with it. But yeah, I'm thinking about like, how would I rearrange this to make it work in various different viewports as well. But mostly I'm just thinking it's pretty cool.
Maybe that's a that good typeface sign of a front developer. First, do you think it's cool?
First, it's cool. And then, yeah, I'm starting to think, okay, well, I like that there's this kind of like sketchy typeface. So is that an actual font that I need to render, or is that just, I'm hoping it's an actual font, not going to be like a PNG or whatever the hell.
It's tricky because at the top, it's like that, I don't know, we're one at the very top. I'm like, no way is that, that's just an image, you know? But then you're like, no, but you need the font because you use it throughout the page. So
yeah, the font is actually giving decent content, like it's giving content. So it would have to bring that font in. Yeah.
But it like angles up in a way that fonts just can't, they don't do that, you know?
Although I guess maybe I could do like maybe a little bit of a skew or a little bit of a rotation. Maybe I could get that.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe a little of both.
Maybe a little bit of both. A little bit of both.
Okay. Well, that's fun. Thanks for participating in our little, let's look at dribble shots together as front end developers happy hour.
on a podcast. So
like happy hour.
It'll be more fun for you listening in cars. You know, we're going to repeat those. So hopefully the front end developers that we invite don't listen to back episodes so they can cheat and look ahead. But we're going to do those same shots. So if you've, you know, week after week, if you plan on listening next week to Shop Talk Show, go, you know, in your free time, go check out the shots so you have them up in your brain for the next time that we talk about them.
This has been very great. Mina, thank you so much for coming on. It's great to hear like everyone's experiences and kind of how they start to think about or how they think and approach building sites. We talk a lot about websites here on the Shop Talk Show, but we don't always get to like kind of inhabit your brain. So thank you so much for sharing your process.
No problem. Thank you very much.
And so for people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Wait, people give me money? I can request money?
This is your chance. You got one shot. we went and saw Hamilton together. It's not going to miss my shot moment.
Yes. So people who are not following me, I'm probably the most prolific on Twitter. So at Mina Markham is really where you can find me. I have my website is mina.codes. It's a little bit outdated, but whatever, forgive me. And those are probably the two biggest places you can get a hold of me. And I don't have any links to give me money, but I mean, if we can work something out, just if you want to give me money, please tweet at me and I will figure out a way to take your money. So thank you very much for that.
And if you run conferences, Mina gives excellent talks. So I will vouch for Mina.
Oh,
and,
no.
Nope. Sorry. Good at it.
It's out there.
You're gonna have to do it.
Yes. I do give a lot of talks. Actually my schedule for 2019 is pretty wide open. So, hey, book me. I'd like to come speak to you all.
There you go. Awesome. Well, thank you again, Mina, for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. And if you've been enjoying this series on how to think like a front-end developer, please star heart or share it on Twitter. Mention us at Shop Talk Show. Follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.